Is somebody chairing?
You can.
I'll chair.
Okay.
Yes.
I think I would change your term about economic elites and call it what it is. It's robber barons. That's what it is.
Fine.
It's right back that time. And what you need, you want to start a movement, what you need is a poster child. And there is one sitting out there that is so beautiful, and I offer it to you. And Snope me on this, or Google me, check it out. The Walton family owns Walmart.
Oh, yeah.
The 10 richest Americans, 4 are Waltons, and each one is worth a minimum of $35 billion. Walmart has more employees on welfare and getting Medicare than any other employer in America. And they're the largest. That's how you start a movement.
That's very good. And you know, maybe the movement started on Black Friday when there were protests at 1,500 Walmart stores. And, you know, those protesters need allies. We should go out there. Michael.
Yeah, I love the historical story, particularly to the point that in the 30s we discovered poor people's problems, but more importantly we discovered poor people's power, right? But by the end of the talk, there's a rediscovery of business power, right? And then sort of in sort of what do we do next with the rediscovery of sort of intellectual power. So what happened to the power of the people, the power of the poor? Can you say more about how that changed over time? Why are they losing now?
Yeah, I had intended, and then I kept looking at the clock. I had intended to tell more about the efforts of in this sort of counter movement of business that began in the 1970s. There was an effort not only to take what people had won and put it in the pockets of the richest Americans, but there was a serious and thoughtful and clever effort to strip the poor of the confidence and standing,
yes,
that had temporarily made them political actors in American politics. And you can see this in the systematic castigation, denigration, stigmatization of poor people in political rhetoric. That was the rhetoric that became the standard rhetoric, standard mantra of Republican campaigns, a campaign against welfare queens, a campaign against criminal drug users, a campaign against the Great Society. You could see it there. You can see it in the Congress people who get up and actually say on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives that we should cut food stamps because it isn't good to feed the crocodiles. I mean, they're not just speaking to satisfy themselves. This is part of a propaganda campaign to separate the poor from the rest of us, even though we're all of us in danger now of stumbling and falling into poverty. Separate the poor and then spit on them, stomp on them, so that their issue becomes not only an issue, not our issue, but it has another effect. It increases the fear that we all have at the pit of our belly, that we too will fall in the gutter. So we have a lot of survey data where poor people keep calling other poor people them. Yes.
So I heard you say that poor means disoriented, people that are disoriented. Can disoriented people effectively engage in political life or community life? I guess the word suffering comes up for me, and whether suffering is an obstruction to the ability to manage logistics.
Well, I don't think I actually said poor people were disoriented. I think I might have said that the upheavals and the hardships to which characterize their lives can have effects which we call social disorganization. But I think even people who are the victims of social disorganization, which means all sorts of things, it means ruptured families, it means ruptured communities, it means, in the most extreme cases, it may mean mental illness, but I have no reason to believe that mental illness is more frequent among the poor than it is among the very rich. I'm skeptical. So, not only that, have you ever engaged in collective action of any kind? I mean,
collective action is super interesting. Right? Who's it? Ostrom studying that?
What?
Ostrom studying collective action. It's a great literature.
There's a great literature on collective action. I was just going to point out that it is great for your mental health. Yes.
Dr. Piven, I always learn a great deal from you. I have a question about your own profession. I'm the faculty union's contract campaign coordinator. It's one of the reasons I came here. So many of the people who do what you do, we are, of course, a huge union representing more than 6,500 public sector workers in the state of New Jersey, but many of the people who, like you, teach or do scholarship of some sort, don't often view themselves as part of the working class. Or as unionists, even as they are tumbling down, and there's been a proletarianization of the university with these sort of neoliberal assaults. How do you challenge some of your colleagues to get more actively involved in fighting back, especially as, you know, people here should understand we're facing, you know, quite a challenge with, you know, a university management that sees itself very much as a corporate management and wants to turn this into a kind of a knowledge factory. And how do you challenge your peers to get actively involved in a fight?
Well, you know, and when you're at that stage of trying to mobilize, I think any constituency could be workers in a factory as well. There's always a great reluctance of people to get involved, partly because it's uncertain, there are risks, and you never exactly know when is the moment when circumstances themselves have made people readier. Hard to know.